Columbia River Carbonates versus Port of Woodland. For our spectators this morning, we have several cases that are on transfer from Division II, which is why you're seeing counsel from Tacoma and Woodland and parts south. How much time would you like to reserve, counsel?
3 minutes.
May it please the court, Charles Kling for Appellant Columbia River Carbonates. CRC, Columbia River Carbonates, is challenging the port sale of real estate to the RV park as an unconstitutional gift of public property and a violation of the statute applicable to the port for selling surplus property. The issue here, Your Honors, the trial court says that the King County versus taxpayer case eviscerated the gift clause, and we disagree. And we think you will disagree when you look at King County versus taxpayer and look at the follow-up case, which was just 5 days later, Clean versus City of Spokane. Those cases did not eviscerate the gift clause. They applied the gift clause in the same legal formulation as traditionally applied, which is unless donative intent is shown or gross inadequacy of consideration, then you apply the legal sufficiency test. The legal sufficiency test is the peppercorn test, which is always met. But the opposite of that is if donative intent is shown or if gross inadequacy is shown, then you have to scrutinize the consideration. And here we show donative intent. Looking at the handout I provided, the big issue on that is the credit that was given for tenant improvements. There was an appraisal, and then the port departed from the appraisal and gave a credit for tenant improvements that were barred by the lease. And there's no doubt.
It wasn't barred by the lease. The lease has a very standard provision. I'm sorry. It wasn't a standard provision, but they sought permission from the port to make some improvements on it to benefit the RV park. And the port was just merely saying, but we're not obligated to pay you for those particular improvements. That's up to you. That's the limitation of that provision. And so how does that then buttress your argument that somehow they shouldn't get a credit because it affected the fair market value of the property, did it not? And aren't they entitled to a credit? Your client would be asking for the same credit.
No, Your Honor. That did not improve the property value. The assessed value by the county was $65,000. That's misstated in the port's brief. And their own appraiser said $65,000 and reduced it to $58,000 for the subject property. And giving that tenant improvement, that credit, where the lease says we're not going to pay you for improvements you do, is going against the lease. It's not an obligation of the port to do that. And that's where we fall into City of Bellevue versus State case, which is the gratuities or tips case. And that says the question is, are you obligated to do it? The court in that case said tips are an obligation. It's a gratuity. It's a custom and practice. It's for services rendered. Here, in this situation with the credit, the lease says that the port is not going to pay you for this. And then when it comes time to sell the property, they say, well, we're going to reduce the purchase price because you did these improvements. And so they were not obligated to do that. And we point to that as donative intent. The record had other information of donative intent, but that is the biggest provision. And so at that point, when there's donative intent, we also showed that the consideration was grossly inadequate. I mean, in our opening brief and the appendix, we have the declaration of the appraiser saying it's $206,000 is the real value of the property, and they sold it for $38,000 when you take off this other sliver that didn't count. So we think that's gross inadequacy. So in either one of those situations, now you move into, and you know, we ask for a jury trial on, you know, the value of this property and whether the port was sufficiently compensated. Every, you know, all the time in the state, we have juries deciding in eminent domain condemnation cases what's the fair value of property. There's a high appraisal by the property, there's a low appraisal by the government, and the jury ignores those and determines what fair value is. And that's what we're asking for here, whether or not the port was giving way, made a gift, or whether they got fairly compensated. Now, you know, the King County taxpayer case is also distinguishable when you look at it on other reasons. You know, they found there was no donative intent based on the prior clean case against the state, where the Stadium Act, this is the Safeco Field case, and there was three cases related to that. The clean case was a challenge to the Stadium Act by the legislature, where the legislature set up this careful system of oversight of the whole Safeco Field financing. And the court said, well, that's not a donative intent. They've got all these safeguards to make sure that it's done right. Here, there's no safeguards at all. I mean, the way you read their briefs, they're saying, well, we don't even have government oversight here. All we have to do is meet the peppercorn test. Well, that's what the gift clause is for. The gift clause is the oversight. The court is the oversight. There's nothing wrong with a court, you know, saying, or a jury saying that the port went too far here and made a gift. And then that protects the public. That's what the oversight is for. So, you know, the King County case is distinguishable on that ground. The otherwise, some things were clear. You know, they raised a bona fide purchaser for value defense that the court ruled below that doesn't apply to the gift clause. They have not cross appealed, so that's not at issue. The bona fide purchaser for value, they tried to apply that. The court found that applied to the statutory claim. The bona fide purchaser for value should not apply because of that requires good faith. And for value, for fair value. There's not good faith here because looking at Appendix E of our opening brief, the email, you know, there's collusion with the port. They're saying keep the chatter down. That first appraisal is unacceptably high. You know, it was not a as they claim, an arm's length transaction.
Who colluded?
The RV park owners with the port.
So you're putting all your collusion eggs into that email, which occurred 5 months before all the public hearings and the resolution, is that what you're saying?
Well, yes, that's part of it. No, there was additional evidence of them working together and to get this sale. I mean, they picked somebody to sell it to in the first place, and then they went on a process to assure that. Now, we have objections about the public hearing. There was insufficient notice, and so the public...
The statute or rule requires notice. These are regular meetings held by the port commissioners. They're held regularly. They have to be recorded and become public records. Maybe you can respond on your time then.
Now or after?
Judge?
It's up to you.
We object. They offered to do a public hearing, and we think the notice was inadequate because there was no notice in the paper and or other typical notice regarding that. And so that hearing is not a typical public hearing where the community is alerted and comes to this public hearing to talk about whether the property should be surplused. Instead, it was, in fact, and when you look at the record, what happened was on Saturday, the executive director sent an email and said, we've got this appraisal, we'll put it on for the meeting on Thursday, I think it was. So there was no time for public notice. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Robert Casey, attorney for CRRVP, the RV park. I will speak for 6 minutes this morning, and Earl Jackson, attorney for the port, will speak for the remaining 4 minutes. The port and ports in general in this state have far less restrictions on their sale of property than other entities such as WashDOT, as seen in the South Tacoma Way case, a case that I was familiar with as I was representing a party in that.
Why shouldn't we be concerned with the fact that the executive director is awfully cozy with the RV park and seems to be negotiating a direct contract that's certainly serving the interests of the RV park more than the port, and not contacting another industrial user who one would absolutely expect to be interested in the property, then misrepresenting that he had.
In this case, the scenario at the time was that you have a prior port director who had received this email from the Carbonates.
Let me start directly with, I understand the port commissioners directed the executive director to see if CRC was interested. He represented at a subsequent meeting they were not. Then in deposition, he subsequently says, I didn't talk to them. Now, he's an agent of the port. Is there misconduct there that demonstrates collusion with the buyer?
I would say no, Your Honor, and the facts are such that he was directed by the port to go visit with CRC, the Carbonates Company. He did that. He went. It was a review of their proposal for their property. He came back from that and was under the impression, apparently, that there was no interest in purchasing this property. That's how I understand the facts. And did he do a stellar job? I think that
it's a question.
Pardon?
He later admits he never asked them.
That's my understanding,
too. So that record suggests that he affirmatively misrepresented the record of the Port Commission.
Either that or he had an understanding based on his meeting with CRC that there was not an interest in this piece of property. He didn't have the prior background of an email where they
said later he didn't ask. I'm just asking if the Port Commissioners, who seem to be trying to do their job right, shouldn't be charged with this kind of, looks like, direct.
Maybe it's grounds.
Fraud.
Maybe it's grounds to fire Mr. Holmberg, who was the executive director of the port, but it's not grounds to set aside this transaction. Look at what the port commissioners knew. They knew what was told to them by the executive director. There's no suggestion of collusion between the executive director and the port commission. There is no suggestion of collusion between my clients and the executive director. He was perhaps naive. It's a staff of two at the Port of Woodland. They look at the facts of a piece of property that had sat unused for 40-plus years, which they understood was a scrappy piece of property that my clients had agreed to clean up in exchange for a low-term lease. As far as Mr. Holmberg knew, there was no other interest in purchasing that property. Did he make a mistake in not asking a direct question of CRC? Possibly so, but that is not attributed to the port commissioners who followed the statute. They had the ability to surplus property. They had the ability to sell property. They had the ability to negotiate a sale with an individual purchaser. There's no requirement for public bidding. The overlay of this, they have to comply with the Open Public Meetings Act. There's no testimony or evidence at all that that was not complied with. And they have to comply with the no gift of public funds constitutional provision, and that has been sustained here too. There's no basis.
Shouldn't we be concerned with your client saying to the executive director, keep the chatter down? We don't want people to know about this. We don't want other interests.
Isn't that
the point?
That email came at a time my clients were going down. They're in their, I won't say how old they are, but they have a place down south that they were heading down to for the fall. They wanted conversations about this to occur when they could attend the meetings. And the context of this, there were nine. It's an interesting scenario. You have nine public meetings where this was addressed in front of the port commissioners. It was about as open as you could ever have a decision to buy and sell property. My clients come up to the dais at an open public meeting and say, you know, we'd like to buy this property from you for $30,000 to $35,000. I can't remember the amount it was. That's what got the ball started, and 18 months later, approximately, the sale was concluded. It was a very open process, open to the public. The port commissioners in their final decision to approve the sale, there's a verbatim transcript of that hearing, and it went on for 10 pages on their decision to, and inquiries of the port commissioner to sell the property. I'm not sure if the clock gives just my time left.
That's your time.
Okay.
Did the public hearing start before or after the email was sent to Mr. Holmberg's predecessor?
Months after, and I'm not sure if it was 10 months or so. As I recall, that email was in the fall, I think maybe August, September, and the public hearing to surplus the property, I believe, was March or April of 2011. So that was the initial public hearing on surplusing the property, and then the following month, I believe it was.
You referenced 9 public hearings. Was this subject listed as an agenda item such that it would have been discernible what the subject was at each of those meetings?
I don't believe so. I believe at the surplusing hearing and the decision to sell the property were both noticed in the agenda. I'm not positive if there were updates listed in the agenda for those prior meetings. It was just a matter of my client showing up and wanting to know what's happening. Thank you.
May it please the court, Earl Jackson, 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 and Kirch, representing the Port of Woodland. The Port of Woodland believes that it did everything right in its power to make this sell correct. We had a unique piece of property, a strip between two properties. We have a statute that gives the port unfettered discretion without having any bids, without having any hearings, to sell properties to a private person. In this case, it was property encumbered by a lease to an existing tenant. That property had been collecting garbage and was a dump area. The port wanted to get it cleaned up. That's how the lease came in.
Would I be correct that Columbia River Carbonates is an industrial use?
Columbia River Carbonates is an industrial use.
And the RV park isn't, and the port's there to develop commercial industrial
property?
They
have also a charge to develop recreational access to public waterways. That's part of the charge to the port as well. It's specific in the statutes, the port statutes.
And what do you make of the fact that the executive director apparently misrepresented the status of your buyers and from all appearances resulted in selling the property for less than somebody else might have been willing to pay?
Well, I think he made a mistake when he didn't say, you know, this property's for sale. I think what he did was he went down there, he met with them, he saw their layout for their proposed, you know, they have a proposed plant down there, and it showed that they wasn't using the strip, and he figured, okay, they're good with it, and that was the basis for his report back to the commissioners. Should he have asked? Yes, probably, but the commissioners acted in good faith. We're talking about a donative intent that has to be found, purposeful donative intent. Yes, there was a mistake made, but the port commissioners were working with a unique property, a property that wasn't, you know, acres and acres like an industrial complex makes. It's property along the Columbia River that you have a 200-foot setback. You got the dike road on the other side of it. It's a strip. The appraisals say the only use for this property is for the two adjoiners. They direct both parties to be contacted. They rely on what they're told, and they negotiate with the existing tenant. There's nothing in that lease that says anything about credits. If you have unlimited, you know, buyers, that's one thing. If you have one buyer that you know of, then you negotiate with them, and, you know, they had offered a lower price initially. That's what spurred the port to get the appraisals and to start the process. It goes a year and a half down the road. All the port minutes are posted on the website, easily seen after each meeting. We have 9 separate public meetings, the initial meeting where it's the offer is there, it's part of the record, and we go down to a public hearing. No public hearing was even required. The port still did that prior to the surplus. So how is the port supposed to react? The court will come in and tell the port, okay, you met the statute, you did everything in your power to do it. Yeah, your executive director wasn't clear. I don't think he intentionally did anything. I think he just, he said he was inexperienced. I think he just assumed that when he saw the plan, it wasn't needed. Is that wrong? Yes. Does the port have any donative intent as a result of that? No. The main issue is this credit issue, but that's consideration. First you find whether there's donative intent, then you look at consideration.
I think he's also arguing it's grossly inadequate.
Well, I don't think it's grossly inadequate. I think it meets the appraisals. The appraiser said we got about $1 a square foot out there in the Woodland Bottoms area of, and what you have, if it's industrial, the first appraisal was based on a residential assumption. If it's industrial, the usable area would go for about $1 a foot, and if you do the calculations, both appraisers pretty much agreed on the usable property being equal to the value. So I think, given the consideration, that it was all reasonable.
Thank you, Council. have about 2.5 minutes, and I don't set this for half, so I'm going to start it after 30 seconds of run.
Thank you, Your Honors. First of all, both appraisals said that the most likely users of the property were the adjacent property owners. And there was two adjacent property owners to the south, the Columbia River Carbonates and Mr. Landell's. And at no time did they ever give notice to those property owners that, hey, we're interested in selling this property. Are you interested? So they had information that they should have used at some point to give notice, besides the early email of CRC expressing interest, which was provided to Mr. Jackson.
Let's assume that Mr. Holmberger, whatever the fellow's name was, wasn't a very good employee. And let's also assume what we know, which is the inquiry with regard to your client's interest in the sale was made to his predecessor. There's nothing about the fact that this transpired over 18 months and that there were apparently nine meeting minutes posted on a website that would in any way give insight into whether or not they had a true donative intent. And it doesn't seem like they're hiding it very well if they're putting these discussions on their website.
I understand that, Your Honor. I mean, number one, the early email was in the record shows it was forwarded to Counsel Jackson, who was continuing to represent the port. So the port had knowledge of that. As far as those public meetings, you still had the situation of what was on the agenda. The actual public hearing listed the address of the RV park and didn't specify what the property for sale actually was. You know, further, I think
if there's something on the Edmond City Council meetings and it lists my next door neighbor's address, I'm not notified because they don't say it's the Lewis's?
Well, obviously, Your Honor, when you provide written notice to the port and you say, please tell me if you're going to ever put this up for sale, you have an expectation to be told that. And, you know, did they attend those meetings? They did not. I admit that. But what we have is...
I'm not talking about a duty on the part of your clients. I'm talking about the actions in publicly expressing the ongoing negotiations. Is that consistent with a donative intent?
You have to look at the totality of circumstances for donative intent. And while there were discussions in meetings, there was also discussions not in meetings. And so I think when you look at the totality, then you do have donative intent. I just want to say he mentioned just
your time is up, Counselor. Thank you. The next matter this morning is film.